the U.S. and its allies may have to weaken it. First, let's cross on over to Beirut and talk to our correspondent, Mariam Saleh, who will give us some highlights, Mariam, if you can, of some of the most important points that Hezbollah Secretary General Seyed Hassan Nasrallah stated today.
Well, usually the speeches of Seyed Nasrallah are very much fruitful. There are so many details in there, but you mentioned one of them, which is very significant, that the liberation of Palestine, liberation of Al-Quds, is very close. And he believes that this is because the resistance force or the resistance alliance in the region is much stronger than it has in the past. He mentioned that the last 10 years or the last decade was one of the most difficult periods that the resistance was able to surpass. And at the same time, there are the different forms of resistance that are also very much in unity in trying to show this strength. And one of them is media. And that was one of the reasons why he was speaking today, to show that media is a partner in the victory that happened lately in the battle for Al-Quds or the previous battles or any battle in the future. And he stressed on that point that the media needs to highlight and needs to voice that need or that equation that all the leaders of the resistance are voicing, which is that if Jerusalem Al-Quds is under any aggression by the Israelis once again, like Sheikh Jarrah in the past, then therefore this would lead to a regional war and not only a confrontation between the Palestinian resistance in Gaza and the Israeli occupation forces. So that is also another very important point that he mentioned and tried to strengthen it, of course, and to highlight that point.
Okay, thank you very much for that. We do appreciate it. That's Mariam Saleh there, correspondent from Beirut. Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier, joins us from Brussels. And also joining us is historian and journalist Brent Jonkers, who joins us from Hasselt. I'd like to welcome you both, and let me start with you first, Brent Jonkers, if I may, and break down one of the highlights of what the Hezbollah Secretary General has said, and that is the U.S. hegemony is the most dangerous threat facing West Asia. Tell us if you agree with that, and in what ways, if you do agree with him, is that true?
Well, I think that's absolutely spot on. Like the U.S. Hegemonistic imperialist venture in worldwide is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, threats that the world faces, and definitely in West Asia or in the region that in the West is often called the Middle East, this hegemony is way more. It's all the more obvious, all the more aggressive, and all the more warmongering, especially in the past 20 years, ever since 2001. I think this is something that it should be so obvious by now that everyone who is not too blind or too unwilling to see it has to admit this. The United States has, through various ways of meddling, interference, aggression, invasion, spread its tentacles around West Asia and is trying to squeeze life out of it, and has been doing this for decades now. Of course, there is the constant bipartisan, support from the United States to Israel to the tune of billions and billions of dollars every single year, both monetary, financial, as of course, a military support. Then there is the support to various imperialist conflicts and the invasion of independent sovereign nations. Of course, we had the invasion of Iraq in 2003, the continuous occupation that still exists to this day, despite constant and repeated demands by Iraq, including the parliament, including the government of Iraq, that the United States has to leave. We've seen the United States' completely illegal invasion of northeastern Syria, the occupation of Hazakah and other areas in northeastern Syria under the guise of what they call the Syrian Democratic Forces, which is completely illegal according to any and all international humanitarian law, completely against the basic concept of national sovereignty of nations. We have seen the invasion in Libya. We have seen the overthrow and the infiltration in legitimate grievances, legitimate protests that existed in the wake of the Arab Spring in 2011, when the United States immediately decided to butt in, to hijack any potential popular outbursts of anger and to steer them towards a way that will end up being more imperialist. And that is, I believe, what Sayed Nasrallah has been talking about when he says that the previous period has been so difficult for the resistance, and yet they succeed in overcoming it and defeating it and coming out stronger. This is that period, especially the last decade, that period of imperialist hijacking of this so-called Arab Spring movement and this massive support of Western imperialist powers to every form of reactionary government, reactionary movement, terrorist organization that wishes to overthrow legitimate governments and states that are too independent to the liking of the West. So all these things together, they constitute a very obvious, I think, evidence of the fact that, like Sayed Nasrallah said, that the United States presence in this hegemony is the biggest threat that West Asia is facing right now, and probably the biggest threat they have faced in a very long time.
Okay, Elijah Magnier, another thing that Sayed Hassan Nasrallah said on the same topic is that the U.S. seeks to expand its hegemony by supporting Israel. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't the U.S. Influence in the region really waning? Because when you took at certain countries like Syria, like Iraq, of course Iran, we know where that stands, even with Turkey and other countries, it's not really the support that it used to have, if you agree. And therefore, is that the possibility of this Abraham Accords to come into the picture, to have that relationship established between them and Israel so that the U.S. remains, so to speak, a player, and at the same time, Israel is protected?
Well, we see that the role of the U.S. in the Middle East is parallel to the ultimate support of Israel and to keep its hegemony in the in West Asia, to prevent Russia, Iran, and China from moving in. We see that the U.S. hegemony is fading slowly but surely. However, the U.S. still has enough power to make sure that this the countries like, for example, Iraq is under its thumb and threatening the Iraqi government with sanctions, like it is doing also with Iran and is doing with Syria and is doing with Lebanon. Therefore, yes, we see that the Americans are supporting Israel to unlimited level. However, the Israeli themselves can see that their power is also declining after the war in Lebanon 2006, after the failure of the partition of Syria and the partition of Iraq, and recently the sword of Jerusalem imposed by Gaza. Israel is no longer as strong as it used to claim to be, the strongest country in the Middle East or the strongest army in the Middle East. On the contrary, we saw that a small number of resistance of people who want to resist against the U.S. hegemony and against the Israeli expansion are managing to impose on Israel its deterrence and making sure that Israel cannot violate their sovereignty anytime Israel wants. And that affects also the U.S. control of the Middle East that is also going down, particularly we see in Syria. The Americans are starting to be under attack. In Iraq, they are under continuous attack by the resistance. Many countries don't want them anymore. They want them to leave. But what the only thing that the Americans are doing is making sure that to create havoc in the Middle East when they are not wanted and they're not trying to do anything constructive.
Well, Brett Yockers, I noticed Elijah Magnier again saying something along the lines that I said, and that is the support of the U.S. for the U.S. is not as it used to be. U.S. still has influence in the region. And Israel is not on the solid footing that it thought that it should be. I mean, if you really think about it, all the support, all the military aid that the U.S. gives Israel, and all the military hardware that the U.S. has spilt into the region, in retrospect, what has that gotten them? Reminds us of what Donald Trump said, that, you know, trillions of dollars and what does the U.S. have to show for it? So when Sayed Hassan Nasrallah says that the U.S. seeks to expand its hegemony to continue its support for Israel, and at the same time, the removal of the Israeli regime and the liberation of occupied Jerusalem al-Quds is closer than ever today, does that hold true in a way that it hasn't in the past, especially when we look at Palestine and the Gaza Strip coming fresh off that the win off that 11-day war?
I think that is absolutely it's absolutely true, and that is something that in it is often let's say obfuscated, especially of course in imperialist mass media, mainstream media. The fact that Israel is this, it claims to be this sort of giant, but it's a giant with a very very weak legs, let's say, to stand on. It cannot, the base of Israel itself, both militarily, ideologically, but even demographically, the base of Israel is extremely fragile. And the most interesting example of that, I think, is the fact that the former head of Shin Bet, which is the internal security service of the Zionist entity, he went to one of the leading newspapers of Israel just a couple of months ago, and he spoke openly in Zionist mainstream media, and he said that Israel will most likely not survive the coming generation, so the coming couple of decades. And the reason for that, he did not even speak necessarily of what will happen militarily, but he said, demographically speaking, the support for Zionism in Israel is based for the most part, on this, what they call these so-called liberal Jews, or these so-called non-religious Jews, so people who are in reality not religiously Jewish at all, but see themselves as still as some part of some sort of chosen race that has the right to this country. But this power base of Israel is, presentially speaking, declining, and especially when compared to other groups that live in the Zionist entity. And which group are those? The majority of the other groups that exist are what the Israeli call Israeli Arabs, but which in reality are Palestinians. The Palestinian population in Israel, especially after the 1967 war and the occupation of East Jerusalem and major parts, of course, of the West Bank, this population has been increasing gradually. And in general, they also have larger families, and they have their percentage, the share of the population is rising. For obvious reasons that I don't think I need to explain, the Palestinians who live in quote-unquote Israel, generally speaking, do not support the Zionist entity or the Zionist project. And the interesting part is that another part of the Zionist population that is growing really massively and exponentially is the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community, people who are actually religiously Jewish. And the interesting thing here is that a big part of these religious Jews also don't support the Zionist entity as it exists. These are Jews who just want to practice their faith. Yes, of course, they want to live in the area where they live in, but they don't necessarily support a Zionist Jew-only state, because they know that they don't need a Jewish-dominated state in order to be Jews. The Jews have lived for thousands of years all across the world, especially in the Middle East, especially in Islamic and Christian nations in the Middle East. They have lived there peacefully and generally unharmed. And these people know that it is possible for a Palestinian state to be multi-ethnic, multi-religious, and still maintain a sort of peaceful coexistence between Jewish, Christians, and Muslims. And so all these things together, that is just purely the demographic point of view. Even if there was no conflict happening, this is what the Shin Bet leader said, even without the conflict, Israel is demographically doomed to fail. Now, when you see, of course, the resistance coming on top of that, this resistance is growing as well exponentially. You have the resistance in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq, mm-hmm. which is increasing their activities more and more and more, and this will come to blows sooner or later, and eventually, I believe, lead to the destruction of the Zionist project and the Zionist colonial entity on the land of Palestine.
Okay, well, let's talk about that, Elijah, if you don't mind expanding more about the axis of resistance. Is something that the U.S. and its allies have not appreciated. They have tried to break that up. How far along have they come, or have they actually been defeated in that journey? Because as it stands, the axis of resistance, if anything, it appears that they've grown stronger. We can take a look at the most recent 11-day war. The Palestinian resistance factions were able to claim victory over that. Many agree that that is indeed what happened. Is that the reality, the new reality, the axis of resistance, unbreakable and to have grown stronger, and the U.S. perhaps has been defeated in trying to break that up?
Well, yes, using different methods. So we see the Americans tried to use boots on the ground by occupying Afghanistan and Iraq, and it didn't work. We saw Israel trying to defeat Hezbollah and didn't work, and exactly the same in Gaza, and we saw also that in Yemen, and through Saudi hands. So now the Americans are trying something else that is called the soft power, and the soft power is to turn the inhabitants against one another. And this is what they are trying in Iraq, and it's, we can't say they are succeeding, but they have succeeded in creating a domestic havoc and turning the population one against another by using legitimate requests like corruption and job opportunities and the lack of basic services, and they use that also in Lebanon. They're imposing sanctions on Syria to turn the population against the government in Damascus. So they're no longer using the military because point they have been defeated militarily. And we saw that Iran moved to the level of full empowerment when it has bombed Ain al-Assad, the largest U.S. base, which means sending a direct message to the American that I am ready to fight face to face, and I no longer need to rely on my allies to do the job, but we all are on the same line. Therefore, there is a new method, and this new method is going toward the population and creating a storm internally and trying to turn people against each other, or the population, the society against the government. And this way, they impoverish the population, they don't care about it, and they create such a discontent so the population blame anybody, including the axis of the resistance, and in this case, in Lebanon, Hezbollah, and in Gaza, Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, and in Syria, the Syrian government, and in Iraq, the Hashd al-Shaabi, or the Iraqi resistance groups that are against the U.S. occupation forces. And partially, they have succeeded partially in doing so. Now it is up to the people to be more aware of the American doing and understand that patience is their best weapons, and that this is part of the war that Israel and the Americans are waging against them because they've been defeated militarily. As simple as that.
Trying to figure out exactly what is going on, Brent Yonkers, when it comes to Syria and the U.S. position. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah did condemn the U.S. airstrikes that happened in the same area, the Syria-Iraq border. And it seems like the U.S. has a focus on Syria that it has not changed from the past, and that is obviously the ultimate goal, is this obsession with having Assad be removed. It even goes as far as talking to its allies, saying do not establish a relationship with Assad, even though they want to, at this point, have accepted the fact that, you know, Assad's there to stay. It had elections, he was reelected. Why is the U.S. so keen on its focus on Syria? Is it because of Israel, to make sure that that pathway is there so that Israel can continue its attacks on Syria?
I think that is absolutely a very important influence. We can never underestimate the influence of the Zionist entity and the Zionist lobbies on anything, especially foreign policy, that the United States is doing. We have seen now in the 11-day war, in the entire conflict, the sort of Al-Quds battles, that the Palestinian resistance seemingly suddenly, had a very modern state-of-the-art equipment at their possession that they most likely have had in their arsenal for quite some time, but now have really been showing. And that that a lot of this arsenal most likely comes through Syria into Palestine. This is one of the big accomplishments as well of the Shahid Qasem Soleimani, of course, is the support of this bringing of modern equipment to Palestine through support and supporters and resistance members and resistance organizations in both Iraq and Syria. And that way you get into occupied Palestine and into the and eventually into the still free part of Palestine, which is Gaza. So when this focus on Syria keeps on going, not so much in the media anymore, because the United States and the Western allies, they try, of course, to sort of downplay the fact that they are still there, that right. They are actually occupying a big part of northeastern Syria, illegally, without even so much as a UN mandate. But this conflict keeps on going. Today, still, there was a report that broke that 45 trucks were seen trucking oil and grain from Syria, stealing it from Syria, and crossing into Iraq to go to American bases. So this is all part, for a big part, of course, of this Israeli Zionist focus on trying to keep on dismantling and balkanizing Syria, with the eventual goal, of course, of destroying Syria as a country entirely.
Yeah, sorry to jump in. I'm going to ask the last question from Elijah Magnier. At the end of his speech, Elijah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah talked about Lebanon, and that this should not be the state of Lebanon, and the reason why it's experiencing such harsh financial meltdown, if you want to call it that, is because the U.S., he didn't put all the blame on the U.S., but he said the U.S. is preventing Lebanon from getting investments into the country because of the sanctions that have occurred, and that it is a major factor in the prevention of Lebanon from advancing to try to bring itself out of the hole that it's in. Is that, again, because of Israel that the U.S. may be doing that? Because Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah and the resistance movement is there in Lebanon?
Hezbollah is the strongest, one of the strongest armies in the Middle East. It is organized by the regular army, and it represents a real danger to Israel. And as I said previously, Israel tried to defeat it and failed. So the only possibility now is to go to internal domestic bickering. And what the problem of Lebanon is, the U.S. support to its allies that are accused of corruption throughout the last three decades. These are the people who are not satisfied with what's happening in Lebanon. They're preventing China from coming in. They're preventing Iran from sending oil paid by the Lebanese with Lebanese lira, local currency that nobody wants, and preventing Russia from reconstructing the country. That is what the Americans are doing. So the pressure remains not only on Hezbollah, but also the society that supports Hezbollah, that is Shia and non-Shia.
Unfortunately, I got to jump in. I'm sorry. We're just fresh out of time. That's Elijah Magnier. Thank you, journalist and political analyst. And thank you, historian and journalist Brent Yonkers, for your comments. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Tarway, and the entire team is goodbye. Until next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَجَعَلْنَاهُمْ أَحَادِيثَ فَبُعْدًا لِقَوْمٍ لَا يُؤْمِنُونَ.
Then we sent our messengers in succession. Every time there came to a nation its messenger, they denied him. So we made them follow one another to destruction, and we made them narrations. So away with the people who do not believe.
Brothers and sisters, we were talking about the 44th verse of this chapter. ثُمَّ أَرْسَلْنَا رُسُولَنَا تَتْرَى كُلَّمَا جَاءَ أُمَّةً رَسُولُهَا كَذَّبُوهُ فَأَتْبَعْنَا بَعْضَهُمْ بَعْضًا. Then we sent our messengers one after another. Whenever they came unto a people, their messenger, they belied him. So we caused some of them to follow others in disaster.
وَجَعَلْنَاهُمْ أَحَادِيثَ فَبُعْدًا لِقَوْمٍ لَا يُؤْمِنُونَ.
We made them stories, so away with a people that do not believe. In the previous program, we concluded that one of the ways of the Almighty Allah, one of the sunan of the Almighty Allah, is sending prophets to various nations, because man cannot develop, cannot reach salvation only through science and thought of himself. That's why we can hear the calls of the prophets throughout the history. But whenever there came prophets and messengers, there were also some people who disbelieved, who tried to deny his prophethood. That's why the verse says, كُلَّمَا جَاءَ أُمَّةً رَسُولُهَا كَذَّبُوا. Whenever there came unto a people a messenger, they belied him. So all the prophets have been denied. There have been existing some people that their only objective in their life was to convince people that this is not a prophet like the previous verses. We had the case of Prophet Noah and also the Prophet Salih, the people of Thamud. And interestingly, in both of these cases, the people were led astray by the chiefs of the disbelievers, by the chiefs of their people. But their fate? The verse says, فَأَتْبَعْنَا بَعْضَهُمْ بَعْضًا. We caused some of them to follow others in disaster. One nation is completely wiped out of the surface of the earth, and the other then becomes existent. So that is the fate and result of denying the truth. The nations perish only because they stood against the truth.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
فَبُعْدًا لِقَوْمٍ لَا يُؤْمِنُونَ. I assume this is the third verse in this chapter, that the verse is ending with a curse. فَبُعْدًا لِقَوْمٍ لَا يُؤْمِنُونَ. Cursing the disbelievers, the atheists. But here, the reason is said within the verse, فَبُعْدًا لِقَوْمٍ لَا يُؤْمِنُونَ. This obstinate disbelieving is the very reason we are allowed to curse them. فَبُعْدًا لِقَوْمٍ لَا يُؤْمِنُونَ. So, away with a people that do not believe. But all these things, all these happenings, have been going on only by Almighty Allah's will. And one of the signs that they were cursed by the Almighty Allah is their fate. The verse says, فَأَتْبَعْنَا بَعْضَهُمْ بَعْضًا. And this, along with part of the verse that says, وَجَعَلْنَاهُمْ أَحَادِيثٍ, we made them as stories, is clearly telling us the result of being obstinate. And this is what happens to those people. Dear listeners, so far we have had two stories discussed in this chapter. First, the story of Prophet Noah, and now the story of Prophet Salih, the people of Thamud who tried to deny the prophets. The chiefs of the people, the chiefs from among the disbelievers, denied his prophethood only based on the reason and argument that he drinks from what normal human beings drink, that he eats from what normal humans. And they tried to establish this fact in the society, this lie in the community, that whoever follows a normal human being like himself, he is an utter loser. But the result is the same as happened to the people of Noah. They were completely destroyed and wiped out from the surface of the universe. The people of Noah were flooded, and these people, فَأَخَذَتْهُمُ الصَّيْحَةُ, as the verse suggested. The blast overtook them. And now in the next section of the chapter, the verses are about another prophet. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. Your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Around the world with reporters.
Huh? Hans Grundberg, known as the ambassador of the European Union to Yemen, is now the UN Special Envoy for the Arab country. He succeeded Martin Griffiths of the United Kingdom, who was appointed in February 2018 but failed to find a peaceful solution to the years-long war on Yemen.
The large number of UN appointments will not change anything as long as there is no will to separate the humanitarian situation from the military and political issues. Changing the UN envoy will return the political process to zero because he will bring new agenda that will certainly serve the US and the Saudi-led coalition, including obtaining new funding for the operational budget of the UN organizations.
The member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mohammed Al-Houthi, says the new UN envoy for Yemen won't bring anything new as long as the Saudi war and the blockade persist. He has called on the UN at its Security Council to stop supporting the US and Britain and start supporting permanent peace.
The recent UN resolutions have proven that the funding that the United Nations obtains from Saudi Arabia affects its decisions. If Yemen had provided funding to the UN envoy and his organization, their international body would have taken decisions in favor of the Yemenis. I believe that there will be no change in the political process, as the United Nations is not serious about committing to the principles and laws on which it was first established, which has become worthless now. All Yemenis have lost their confidence in the UN and all those who follow it.
Millions of Yemenis have been under a tight blockade since March 2015, when Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a devastating war on Yemen to reinstate a friendly regime there. The war has brought Yemen to what the UN calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Observers say neither Grundberg nor anybody else can put an end to the suffering of millions of Yemenis as long as the UN puts a blind eye to Saudi atrocities. That's due to the kingdom's funding for the world body. They believe that Yemeni military operations are the only way to push Riyadh toward a political solution. Abdul Latif Roshali, Sana'a.
The Sudanese government vowed to work with Ethiopian parties to enhance Ethiopia's unity amid the current conflicts in the African country. In a statement, Khartoum said it would work with the regional and international community to achieve peace in the neighboring country. Following an emergency meeting to assess the overall situation, it also urged all conflict parties to sit around the negotiation table and ensure humanitarian aid access to all those in need. The conflict in Tigray, Ethiopia has driven over 70,000 refugees in impoverished eastern Sudan. The United Nations agencies and aid groups struggle to evacuate them from the border and provide them with shelter. Millions are at risk of starvation as the brutal civil war in Tigray is reaching a turning point, with thousands of captured Ethiopian government troops arriving in the region. Tigray has been in the scene of fighting since Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed sent army in early November to topple the dissident regional authorities, which emerged from the Tigray People's Liberation Front. After early successes and a premature declaration of victory, government forces were bogged down in a vicious and months-long battle with pro-TPLF fighters. The Ethiopian army was backed by troops from the neighboring Amhara region and the army of Eritrea, which border Tigray.
The lengthy conflict between Ethiopian federal government and the Tigray front had already affected negatively not only Sudan and Ethiopia in particular, but also the Horn of Africa in general. This has prompted all the regional states to seek for a way to end the conflicts in Ethiopia. Muhammad Ali Fazari, Khartoum.
This is the first time that three Iranian innovations have been approved and funded by the Global Innovation Exchange. Speaking at a press conference, head of Iran's national invention team said that the innovations have been evaluated by such international organizations as USAID, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundations before they receive the funds. Global Innovation Exchange is a global development technology platform for innovations, funding, and insights. The three Iranian innovations include the Genetics of Success by Mohammad Aryan Akbari, which is one of the top ideas, which introduces a new formula to predict an individual's likelihood of success and could raise $187,500 fund from Turkey. And the next project is a Smart Hospital project by Amir Abbas Mohammad Kushki, which has managed to attract $2 million fund. The third Iranian project approved by the Global Innovation Exchange has been proposed by Zahra Ghazavi, which is a cuffless blood pressure measuring device based on light sender and receiver sensors. Moreover, Iran's national invention team has won several shining medals at Turkey's Global Innovation and Invention Contest, Technofest 20 and ISIF 20, which were held by the World Intellectual Property Organization and the International Federation of Inventors Association, in association with Turkish Ministry of Economy and Turkish Intellectual Property Organization. In this round of competitions, Amir Abbas Mohammed Kushki won silver medal for its smart robot preventing coronavirus. Dr. Aryan Akbari backed bronze medal for his Genetics of Success formula, and Zahra Ghazavi won silver medal for her blood pressure measuring device. Moreover, for the first time, two Iranian innovations have made way into MIT University Global Challenge Solve MIT, which have been published on its website.
This is the first time that a number of Iranian innovations have been well received at Global Innovation Exchange and have attracted international funds to develop the projects. Saman Kujurib, Tehran.
I do hereby declare that Kim Michelle Leadbeater is duly elected.
The UK Labour Party secured a narrow win in the key by-election constituency of Batley and Spen in northern England. The results announced early Friday morning shocked many, as Labour was tipped to lose the seat to either the ruling Conservatives or Workers' Party GB candidate George Galloway.
The battle for Batley appears to have left a bitter taste after accusations of racism, harassment and even dirty tricks has circled the headlines over the past couple of weeks, with Batley's Muslim community also apparently playing a key role after turning their backs on the Labour Party over perceived policy injustices regarding Palestine and Kashmir.
Amid accusations of poster vandalism by Labour activists, Mr. Galloway vowed legal action.
We have been multiply defamed to the point that I'm no longer prepared to talk with the mainstream media, which is why I'm talking to you now by this live stream. The whole election campaign was dominated by lazy and false tropes about our campaign, about the thousands of people that voted for us, about their motives for doing so, in a way which defamed them as much as it defamed me.
Despite Labour's win, experts claim Muslims still sent a strong message by removing their traditional loyal support.
So Muslims, this is an opportunity to build alliances with the voiceless in our wider communities. And for those who are outside of the Muslim community, look at us as your allies. We want to flex our political muscles, and we are happy to do so alongside you, inshallah.
Despite Labour's win, British Muslims remain deeply frustrated. This aspect could affect future votes unless the party changes its policy towards Muslims dramatically. Robert Carter, London.
Bagram Military Air Base in northern Parwan province was known as an American town since it was considered as the biggest U.S. military base in Afghanistan. Now, no American troop is in Bagram, and it has been handed over to the Afghan government.
Both the Afghan government and the Taliban have welcomed the move. However, the militant group says the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan's Bagram air base is a hasty escape and the rising Taliban attacks across the country.
Meanwhile, many Afghans say the withdrawal needs to be viewed as a chance to remove violence from the country.
Political players in Afghanistan need to view the withdrawal of foreign troops as a big opportunity to end violence here. Both government and the Taliban must now get back to negotiations to settle the problems.
Afghan officials have always blamed the Taliban for waging war under the pretext of fighting foreign invasion. And now they call on the Taliban to logically decide on the fate of their own war-torn homeland.
If the excuse was foreign troops' presence, they are leaving now. Other issues such as ignoring the Republic or the Constitution by the Taliban don't make sense anymore. Challenges such as corruption could now be discussed peacefully. So we expect the Taliban to respect the nation's demand and responsibly resume intra-Afghan talks.
Some 9,600 foreign troops should leave Afghanistan by September 11, a deadline set by US President Joe Biden, who seeks to end America's longest war. It was launched in 2001 under the pretext of fighting terrorism. However, no peace has been achieved yet, and thousands of Afghans have lost their lives since then. Afghan officials say government forces are fully ready to independently defend the country amid withdrawal of foreign troops. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Iranian city of Qom marks the end of a week-long occasion known as the U.S. Human Rights Week. The annual event commemorates a series of tragic incidents that killed hundreds of Iranians. The last day of the week, which falls on July the 3rd, marks the 1988 shooting down of an Iranian airliner by the U.S. Navy, which killed all of the 290 people on board. After more than three decades, Iran is still waiting for an apology from the U.S. The American Human Rights Week also commemorates the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of Iran's Islamic Republic Party, carried out by the formidable Mujahideen-e-Khalq terrorist organization, known as the MKO. 73 leading officials, including the then Justice Chief Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti, were killed in the terror attack. In 2012, the U.S. and Europe delisted the MKO as a terrorist entity, and since then, they have been holding regular meetings with the terror group, which is now based in France and Albania. The 1987 chemical bombardment of Iran's city of Sardasht is another incident that falls in the same period on the Iranian calendar. Iraq's chemical weapons were reportedly produced using materials supplied by the U.S. and other Western countries. The 1981 attempted assassination of the then-Iranian president Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei by the MKO is also among the incidents that's marked in the American Human Rights Week.
Iran says the U.S. footprints can be traced in all of the incidents that fall in this fateful week. Activists here say Washington has so far shrugged off its crimes in Iran. And that is why Iran marks the American Human Rights Week every year to present documented instances of gross violations of human rights by the U.S., at least in Iran. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Qom.
Over 1 month since a ceasefire came into force between the Israeli regime and Hamas, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip still suffer from psychological trauma and feel unsafe. While fears are rising of another round of violence, Palestinians mark 15 years of a land, air, and sea Israeli blockade that has devastated Gaza's economy and caused widespread destruction, leaving most people largely cut off from the outside world.
The Israeli blockade imposed for 15 years led Palestinians to call for simple solutions. This blockade, of course, affected all life aspects, especially the rate of poverty and unemployment. There are many graduates who are jobless now. Wars and Israeli blockade isolated Gaza from the world, and it's not surprising that many countries know nothing about Gaza.
Israeli blockade imposed on the Gaza Strip affected badly on all life aspects, leading to high rates of poverty and unemployment. Most of the working-age population in the Gaza Strip are unemployed and without any source of income due to the lack of job opportunities.
There are a lot of graduated people without a job in Gaza. The unemployment rate is high and there are no job opportunities. For 15 years, we have been living in the same situation. There has been continuous escalations and war over Gaza, and people will suffer from everything and nothing changes.
Due to the limited sources and restrictions imposed on movement and entry of goods and fuel, only a limited amount of fuel and cooking gas reach homes and the electricity plant. As a result, Gazans are suffering an electricity crisis that has devastated daily life, especially on clean water, as people in Gaza suffer from salty and polluted water that is not fit for drinking. both the continuous violence over the Strip and the Israeli blockade affected badly on every aspect of life for Palestinians, isolating and depriving them from their rights. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Stop denying racism and start dismantling it. Those were the unequivocal comments by Michelle Bachelet, the United Nations Human Rights Chief, following a landmark report launched after the killing of George Floyd in the United States, which called on countries worldwide to do more to tackle the systemic racism against people of African descent.
I'm calling on all states to stop denying and start dismantling racism, to end impunity and build trust, to listen to the voices of people of African descent, and to confront past legacies and deliver redress.
The report found that police use of racial profiling and excessive force was systemic in much of North America, Europe, and Latin America.
We're suffering right across the world. Adam Traoré in France, George Floyd in America, Dalian Atkinson and Kevin Clark here in the United Kingdom. You know, 24 people were shot in the favelas of African descent by Brazilian police, you know, in the last 12 months. So you can see that wherever you look.
It also concluded that racism was the biggest problem in countries steeped in the history of the transatlantic slave trade, which ultimately laid the foundations for much of the wealth they enjoy today.
The report highlighted the UK as one of 60 countries that needs to do more to help bring an end to systemic racism, notably urging them to apologise to people of African descent and make amends through reparations. Yet despite the UK playing a leading role in the transatlantic slave trade, so far the British state has shown an unwillingness to do either.
Michelle Bachelet acknowledged the pivotal role that the Black Lives Matter movement played in bringing this conversation to the forefront, but accepted that now it's on states around the world to take concrete action and make amends for centuries of violence and discrimination. But for countries like the United Kingdom, just issuing an apology would be a start. Ahmed Kabbalah, London.
American and NATO forces have finally left Afghanistan's Bagram Air Base, the hub of the US military operations in the country for nearly 20 years. The pullout marks a symbolic end to what US President Joe Biden has called Washington's forever war. It comes after Biden announced earlier this year his decision to withdraw all US forces from Afghanistan by the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. The pullout has been welcomed by the Afghan people.
This is good news that the Americans left Bagram. The Americans had reached an agreement with the Taliban in Doha, and these agreements must be implemented. And this is for the good of Afghanistan.
God willing, there will be peace in this country. We want peace until the end. God is merciful, and we hope that one day there will be peace in our country.
The Taliban militant group has also welcomed the withdrawal as a positive step. The group's spokesman said the full withdrawal of foreign forces will pave the way for Afghans to decide about their future themselves. In February 2020, the administration of former President Donald Trump struck a deal with the Taliban to withdraw all U.S. troops from Afghanistan by May 2021. Joe Biden rescheduled the date and set September 11th for the pullout. The U.S. and its NATO allies invaded Afghanistan in October 2001 under the pretext of the so-called War on Terror. The Taliban militant group was removed from power following the invasion. However, after nearly two decades, the U.S. invasion failed to uproot the militant group, and Washington had to finally sit at the negotiating table with the group. According to the Pentagon, the U.S. military operations in Afghanistan have cost nearly $825 billion. Also, according to U.S. media reports, more than 2,400 U.S. military personnel have been killed in Afghanistan. The U.S. war in Afghanistan has left thousands of Afghan civilians dead and caused a significant damage to the country's infrastructure. And now, with the prospect of an end to the war, which though failed to bring security to the country, calls will certainly get louder for the prosecution of American troops and officials involved in the war crimes against the Afghan people.
The leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki, is standing trial for allegations of culpable homicide, unlawful assembly, disruption of public peace, among other charges which the Islamic cleric has denied. Rounding up his address to the court, the leader of the defense team explained that the prosecution has not established any case against Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki. He said none of the people accused of the crimes attributed it to his client, and the court has released many of them.
If we feel that no prima facie case has been established against your client, you make a no-case submission, and that is what has happened in this case. So we are waiting for the ruling of the court.
The prosecution has presented a total of 15 witnesses, including Nigerian military officers. But Zazaki's defense team said all the witnesses that were brought before the court confirmed that they did not see Sheikh Zazaki during the attack by the army.
The prosecution called 15 witnesses. We felt that no case has been made to warrant our clients being asked to give evidence. In other words, we address the court to defend that there is nothing to defend on the part of our client.
The trial judge adjourned the case to July 28, when he is expected to deliver his ruling on the no-case submission by Zazaki's defense team. Sheikh Zazaki has been in detention since December 2015 after soldiers of the Nigerian army attacked his home and worship center, killing over 340 of his supporters. Members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria have continued with their protests, demanding the release of Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki and his wife Zinat. They have always insisted that the Islamic cleric is an innocent man who has suffered persecution by the Nigerian government. Anjum Abdullahi, Kaduna.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. In this episode, we are going to talk about some of the Islamic laws of miscellaneous nature according to Ayatollah Sistani. Before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzumah Sabzawari and Sharh Ashraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazwini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in fiqh and usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 13.